Does money buy happiness? It's an age-old question, one that we're going to answer once and for all right now on the Motley Fool Radio Show. Laura Rowley is the personal finance expert for Self Magazine and the author of the new book, Money and Happiness, A Guide to Living the Good Life. Her Motley resume caught our eye. She's been a business reporter and producer for CNN. She has a master's in divinity and currently teaches a course on contemporary moral values at Seton Hall University. She joins us from CBS Studios in New York City. Laura Rowley, welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thanks, David.
Laura, why'd you write the book?
I've always been interested in business and personal finance and also in ethics. When I worked at CNN covering the markets at night, I got my master's in divinity. And now I write this personal finance column and I teach the course. And in the course, we talk a lot about the relationship between happiness and living a life that's built on your core values. And so through the magazine, I kept meeting women who were struggling because they had this gap between what their personal goals were, what they said they wanted to do with their lives, you know, whether it was start a business or go back to school, and what they were actually doing with their money, which was either not investing it or running up credit card debt. And so I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to write a book about how money relates to your happiness and how do you identify what it is you really value and then use money as a tool to maximize your happiness?
You mentioned women. Laura, you write that the book is particularly aimed at women. Why?
Well, I aimed it at women for a couple of reasons. Women live longer than men. They earn less than men on average. They're more likely to leave the workforce to take care of children or to take care of aging parents. The average is about 10 or 11 years out of the workforce. And 9 in 10 women, according to one study, earn less than $40,000 a year. So it's really important to start as early as possible saving for retirement and things like that. And to understand, you know, how to maximize your money, how to manage your money. Also, women tend to invest more conservatively than men. So their money doesn't grow as quickly as somebody who's investing in stocks or bonds versus, say, a money market fund.
Laura, you're here to answer a few age-old questions. In a second, I'm going to ask you if money buys happiness, but I have to ask you first, are women really from Venus and are men from Mars?
That's an excellent question, David. Well, I would say money-wise, there are definitely differences between men and women. I mean, I've actually seen studies that show men will tend to overspend because they want to show power and prestige. They want to show how well they're doing, where women will overspend for emotional reasons. Like they'll get a relationship going with somebody in a store and feel like they have to buy something in the store in order to maintain the relationship.
And I don't want you to give away the ending to your book, but in your humble opinion, once and for all, does money buy happiness?
I would say a certain amount of money does buy happiness. You have to have your basic needs met. But beyond that, our happiness doesn't rise in proportion with our income. And I looked at some of the studies on this. We've had big jumps in economic growth over the past few decades in countries like the U.S. and Japan, but only marginal increases in the amount of happiness people report enjoying. So they've also done surveys of lottery winners that find lottery winners are only slightly happier than the average Joe. They've done surveys of the Forbes 100, who obviously are up there in the big bucks. And also, they don't report gigantic levels of happiness above the way the average person reports it.
So you said a certain amount of money buys a certain amount of happiness, and I get that. I have to put you on the spot, though, Laura. Are we talking $50 here, $25,000? How much money is buying how much happiness?
Well, I think it depends on your cost of living. I mean, once you achieve a certain standard of living, it's interesting. One study I looked at said people who earn $50,000 or more in the U.S. have fewer blue days than people who earn less. So the median income in the country is about $43,000. I think if you're at the median and you can cover your housing expenses and you can cover your utilities and you can cover a few, you know, a little fun money, you're doing fine. But what scientists have found is the pursuit of money as a primary goal actually has negative consequences for your mental health.
And what is happening to me if I'm doing that?
Well, you have lower self-esteem. you're more likely to be depressed. You have more trouble in your relationships. It's a very interesting series of studies that were done over a number of decades that found this. And it was across the board. It was the same depending on your age or even the country you lived in. There were negative results. And it wasn't from wealth itself. It wasn't being affluent that had negative results. It was making the pursuit of money and material goods the number one or number two goal in your life.
In your book, Laura, you write that we need to identify our money personalities. Now, what are money personalities?
Well, this I came up with this after interview. I interviewed dozens and dozens of women for this book, and their stories are in the book. And what I found is there were definitely personality types emerging from these interviews. I talked to people for more than an hour, and you would see people who obviously had a direct connection between money and sort of love and comfort. And they talked about how they spent on luxury goods and how they loved to shop and how generous they were with their friends and they bought a lot of gifts. And then there were people I call money mystics who were afraid to ask for money, felt like somehow money would taint them, were sort of afraid of being greedy. And then there was definitely a planner personality, somebody who uses Quicken, has it all mapped out, knows what they want to do, maybe tends to be a little bit stingy. So what I did was put together a quiz, and I talked to people about their behaviors, and I identified some of the behaviors that go with the personality, and then I asked people to take the quiz to find their money personality. To me, the analogy is knowing, for example, if you're a morning person or an evening person, if you're going to have an important meeting with a big client, you want to know when you're going to be at the top of your game. If you understand your money personality, you can adjust some of your money behaviors so that, you know, you have healthy money behaviors.
You cite a number of studies in the book, including a study done by Richard Easterland, a USC professor who looked at the link between money and happiness and came up with the phrase hedonic treadmill. Please explain.
Hedonic treadmill. This is one of my favorite discoveries in the book. Richard Easterlin is one of the pioneers of research on happiness. And the hedonic treadmill basically means we quickly adapt to an improvement in our circumstances and then we want more. You know, and it's kind of a funny thing because if you have good health, you usually don't think, oh, I want super duper health. Or if you have a good, you know, a happy family, you don't think, oh, I really want two families. But when you have a little bit of money or a little bit of material goods, you always want more. Yeah, and I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan with two kids, and we moved to a four-bedroom house. And this is like dying and going to real estate heaven. Just a couple of years later, I was thinking, you know, if we just bumped out this wall, I could have an eat-in kitchen, and it sure would be nice to have a master bath in this house. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, you know, gee, I want a little bit more. And we just... We can't seem to help doing that.
What's the difference between wanting a little bit more and just wanting to improve one's condition continuously?
Well, I think it can get into a vicious cycle. I mean, I think at some point you have to stop and say, you know, what is it requiring in terms of my time and energy to continue improving my circumstances? You know, because you'll end up having to work to earn more money so you can bump out that wall. And then, of course, that's probably going to raise your real estate taxes and become another monetary liability. So you have to work a little bit harder to pay for that. And so, you know, I think that cycle can suck up a lot of energy and time when the research that has been done shows that what makes us happy is relationships, work that we value and enjoy, that sort of thing. So, you know, at a certain point, the more you chase material goods, the more money you're going to need to finance that life cycle and the less options you're going to have to maybe take a lower paying job that you enjoy more. It's funny, I do this little experiment with my students every semester. I ask them, tell me what the good life looks like for you. And we put it all up on the board. It's everything from, you know, the McMansion to the sports car to the loft in Tribeca to the, you know, the model husband or wife. And then I say, what would you do if somebody, some mystery benefactor showed up and gave you all of this tomorrow? How many of you would take it? And inevitably, about half of my students say they wouldn't take it. They say, that's why I'm here. That's what I'm working for. And the process of working to achieve those goals is sort of what my life is all about. So, you know, I'm encouraged that 50% say they wouldn't take it. I'd like to get it up to 100%.
Wow. Okay, Laura Rowley, author of Money and Happiness, it's time to put on your judge's hat for this week's Fool Radio game. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It's a game we'll call Folly and Finance. That's admittedly a working title, not something we're wed to. Our player is Doug from Charlotte, North Carolina. We're going to ask him three questions. He starts out with three full ball caps, and Doug will lose a cap for each incorrect answer. Welcome, Doug.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's great to be here, or there, wherever you are.
You ready to play Folly and Finance or Money and Happiness or something like that?
Sure, as long as I don't have to pay.
Well, let me ask you this, Doug, and you don't. Can money buy happiness in your mind?
In my mind, maybe temporarily.
Okay. Laura, sounds like you would not disagree.
No, I wouldn't disagree. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's start off with question number one. Doug, we'll call this Give Me Credit. Here we go. What percentage of Americans pay off their credit cards in full each month? Three choices for you. Is it A, 22% due, B, 55%, or C, 77% of Americans pay off their credit cards in full each month? Which one?
I'm going to have to go with A. Man, I just lost a hat.
Laura, what was the answer? You're right. Laura, what was the answer? What does Doug need to learn here?
It's an astonishing 55%.
So, wow. Doug, you need to have more faith in people.
Well, see, I mean, I pay mine off. I mean, my wife does. She makes me.
And you thought you were different.
But, well, you know, we talk to our friends, and nobody else seems to be able to do that, so I just assume the lower. If you could give me, like, 5%, I probably would have picked that.
Well, it sounds like you need to let a little bit more of yourself rub off on your friends.
Well, I don't know about that.
Question number two, Doug. We'll call this one financial aid. According to a 2002 study by Nellie Mae, what is the average student loan debt of college graduates who borrow money to finance their educations? Three choices once again for you, Doug. Is it A, $5,200, B, $18,900, or C, $42,000?
B. Hey.
You're a ringer. You keep the cap. Laura, what is your reflection on that statistic?
I think it's quite a bit of money, and I think it's hard when you start out with that amount of debt. I myself was fortunate in that I worked a couple of jobs in college and got a scholarship, and my parents helped me out a little bit. And I'm the 10th of 11 kids, so my dad always said, no debt, wow. No debt. So I was lucky to come out without debt, and I think it was very helpful. You know, instead of having to pay for student loan debt, you can start that retirement plan right away.
It is a high statistic, and obviously we have two things going on here. We have are parents saving enough, or are college costs escalating out of control? Which one would you point to, Laura?
I think it's both. Mm. I have talked to lots of people who, during my interviews for the book, who talked about valuing education, their own education, their children's education. I said, well, so how much do you have saved for your child's education? Well, we haven't really started. Well, how old's your child? 9. Mm. Well, that's, you want to start a little earlier than that, and then you just have to put a little bit aside until they're in college versus having it all sort of balloon up on you at a late date and then panic and then end up having to take out loans yourself and have your child take out loans.
Doug, any student debt in your life?
No, actually, what she was talking about. I have two kids, and we paid for our daughter completely up front. We paid all 4 years up front with the, at today's rate, she can go, you know, anywhere in the state of Virginia. That's where we were living there. And then North Carolina doesn't have the same program, but we are working a program with her company that my son is 3 months old, and we've already paid a couple grand into that.
Mm. Congratulations. Wow. That's wonderful.
Burden off. At least, you know, if something happens to us, their education is taken care of, and that's what's more important to us.
That is really wonderful. And you get a full ball cap in the mix as well.
Deal. That's why I keep a little bit more hair.
Okay, last one for you, Doug. Question number three, fact or fiction is the title. Doug, which of the following is not a line from Laura Rowley's book, Money and Happiness? This one of these three is not a line from her book. Is it A, quote, Michelle recently moved closer to New York City from an outlying suburb and her rent nearly doubled, end quote? Or is it B, quote, money can't make a relationship, but it surely can break it, end quote? Or finally, is this not the line? Quote, you need a sexy-looking glass bottle, preferably blue-tinted, end quote. Doug, is it A, B, or C, the fictional line?
I'm going to have to go C.
Thank goodness.
Sure enough, and actually, I have to admit, And we're usually not self-promotional at all on the show, but that is, in fact, a quote from The Motley Fools, You Have More Than You Think, a section we wrote on saving money by bottling your own water. Doug, you are...
I'm going to try that.
Doug, you are a winner on this show. And, if you were to bottle your own water, you want to quickly make up a brand name that you might try to sell it under?
Junk Water.
You know, I can see that working. You go
homemade.
I like it. Kind of a guerrilla marketing campaign to get the word out about that. Doug, congratulations on being a winner on the show. It sounds like, as well, a winner in your personal finance life, too. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Laura Rowley is the author of Money and Happiness. Laura, how about some parting wisdom, some maybe spiritual insight on money and happiness?
I think money is a tricky thing, but so is happiness. One of my favorite studies, researchers did a study where they randomly put a quarter in a phone booth, and some people find it and some people don't. And then immediately afterwards, the researchers asked them to rate their life satisfaction overall, the satisfaction with their entire life. People who find the quarter actually report a higher overall life satisfaction. Mm. So I would say it's important to separate your definition of genuine happiness from temporary mood, and that lifelong happiness involves achieving goals we set for ourselves. And sometimes that involves some short-term pain. You know, you can't spend that money now because you're saving for that long-term goal of a house or child's education. But visualizing what it's going to be like when you get there is a good way to ensure your long-term happiness.
I agree. Of course, another interpretation of that could have been that we shouldn't overrate the value of a quarter.
That's true. and really, you know, it's only a quarter. Isn't it 50 cents to make a phone call these days?
Laura Rowley, the author of Money and Happiness, thank you for joining us on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
My pleasure.
We play a lot of games on the Motley Fool Radio Show. In fact, we play one each week, and you can always hear this game and this show online at fool.npr.org. And to keep updated on all things happening at Fool Radio, sign up for our free weekly radio email. Hop on to Fool.com, scroll down to the free email newsletter section, and click on Fool Radio Weekly.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. Nothing quite as wonderful as money.
Money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that wakes the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase, for it's money.